Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLachlan. Jay McLachlan is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLachlan and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLachlan stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLachlan's local and loyal programming. Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLachlan's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern. And the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLachlan. And so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLachlan is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20. Capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital ZIBBY20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white, open, long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLachlan. Thanks so much.
Hi, this is Zibby Owens, and you're listening to the award-winning podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. I'm also the host of Moms Don't Have Time to Lose Weight, and I'm the editor of the anthology, which you should run out and buy, called Moms Don't Have Time To, a quarantine anthology. All proceeds of that book go to COVID-19 vaccine research. And I'm the editor-in-chief of Moms Don't Have Time to Write, a new publication on Medium, and we're accepting submissions, so please send your personal essays there. And if all that isn't enough, you can follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens, and my website is ZibbyOwens.com. Okay, now back to this amazing podcast. Miriam J. A. Chancy is the author of What Storm, What Thunder, a novel. Miriam is a Haitian-Canadian-American writer, the HBA chair in the humanities at Scripps College in Claremont, California, and a fellow of the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. Welcome, Miriam. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss What Storm, What Thunder.
Thank you so much for having me, Zibby. I've been following your podcast and I love it. I'm really happy. And you're the first podcaster to contact me about What Storm, What Thunder. So I really appreciate your attention to it. Yeah.
Wow.
You're the first person to book us. So
that's really nice. I have to jump on the good things. I don't know what to say. I know a good thing when I see it.
I'm so happy to hear it.
Oh, that's awesome. I do like the advance notice. It's good to, book. Anyway, whatever. Delighted. Yeah. Delighted that that happened. Would you mind telling listeners what your book is about and what inspired you to write it? Which in this case is fairly obvious, but anyway, you tell them.
Yeah, I'm originally from Haiti. I'm from Port-au-Prince. And, the earthquake of 2010 was really shattering for, people in Port-au-Prince, for my family, acquaintances and colleagues. And I spent several years, so I'm also an academic, I'm a scholar of Caribbean literature and Haitian women's literature specifically. And so I was known for having written on those topics. And so I was booked for a lot of talks about best practices, what would happen to vulnerable communities after the earthquake of 2010, which killed upwards of 250,000 people and left 1.5 million people homeless. And I wasn't planning to write the novel at all. You know, I had another novel come out of the UK in 2010, which was about a hurricane season, which had been devastating around 2004. And I really did not have writing a novel on my mind at all, especially because, you know, at that time, we were really just in the process of helping survivors, you know, with, you know, all the material needs that people had and also grieving, right? And but every time I gave a talk, people, especially Haitians, you know, who had survived, would come and talk to me about their experience of the earthquake or who they had lost. And, you know, several years later, I was actually in Trinidad speaking to a Trinidadian painter, Leroy Clark, who unfortunately just passed away a couple of weeks ago, an elderly painter, sort of a national treasure in Trinidad. And he had been painting as a result of the earthquake. He had been moved to continuous series. He had started at the end of a Duvalier regime in 1986. It was a large-scale painting he had started but never finished. And then after the earthquake, he started a series. And when I saw his paintings, he was at 77, and he went on to paint, I think, 111 paintings. And he didn't quite know what they meant. And when I came into his studio, I just started weeping. And he said, "What do they mean?" And I started telling him what I saw. He had never been to Haiti. He had never met Haitian painters. He's not studied Haitian painting, but they really spoke to me about what was happening in Haiti. And so I went home from Trinidad and I just started thinking, what did this mean for me? And the novel just came, an outline for the novel, the characters. And I'm sure that part of the process was just the accumulated knowledge that I had gathered all those years of giving talks, listening to others, my own experiences, you know, going back to Haiti from 2011 forward. It just coalesced into a sort of clear message about what I needed to do. In a sense, it was like people were telling me their stories because I was a writer, but until I met Leroy, I didn't get the message that, you know, you're a writer, you should do something, you know, on our behalf. And that's what I ultimately did. So I started writing in 2013, which was several years after the earthquake. And then it took me several years to write it.
And so were the stories in the book about all the different characters, were any of them real or were they based on composites or?
No, none of them are real. The only, you know, seed that is factual was that I did meet someone who survived the falling of a well-known hotel in Haiti, where most of the people who were reported as surviving that hotel were UN and NGO workers. And the person I met was a person of color, and I had not heard of anyone in the hotel who was of color, who was Haitian, surviving. And he didn't tell me a lot of information, just, "I was there, I survived, it changed my life." And that, when I got to writing, spawned three characters: Sonia, who is a sex worker in the hotel, Dieudonné, who is a fixer, and her best friend. And both of them think of themselves as M, which is the categorization for queer in Haiti. And then Leopold, who is trapped in the hotel itself and is Trinidadian. And so that was also my homage to Trinidad and the connection to Trinidad.
Did Leopold or Leroy, what did you say?
It's Leopold.
Leopold. Did he do the painting on the cover?
No, I mean, he's one of the characters, and he's actually
I'm sorry.
A drug traffic. I'm sorry. Oh, you're talking about Leroy.
I'm sorry, Leroy. Yeah, Leroy.
The painter.
Yeah.
No, Leroy. No, I did not ask him for a painting for the cover. The cover was designed by Diane Chonette, who's an in-house art director, and she did a wonderful job. She was inspired by a passage in the novel where I talk about the flap of hummingbird wings, the noise of the earthquake. Various people have different ways of talking about that noise, but I talk about the flap of hummingbird wings. And if you've ever had a hummingbird come really, really close, it's just like a little bit like a thunderclap. It's really stunning. And so she was inspired by that. And I don't know if your listeners would know about this, but James Audubon was actually born in Saint-Domingue. And I'd been researching that fact for years. And so she didn't know that when she designed the cover. The cover is taken from images by Audubon's rendition of hummingbirds in Haiti.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, so that's all connected.
Are you willing to share what your family's experience was in in 2010?
Sure. You know, most of the family that I have left in Port-au-Prince is older, is elderly. We had one of my father's half-brothers, his mother was crushed in the earthquake, passed away in that way. We had some family members who lost homes. They were able to rebuild years later, but there was a lot of material loss in that sense. I was connected to a lot of Haitian women's movements at the time, and all of the leaders of the Haitian women's movement died, people like Myriam Merlet. And so women's groups had to rebuild in that time. And then I also had a number of friends who had either students or, you know, colleagues who were in Haiti, but they were trying to track down. And there is a passage in one of the characters' sections and section that's actually true to life to what happened to me, which is that I had a friend who was in Puerto Rico, was trying to track down a student who had supposed to report to the University of Puerto Rico around, you know, after January 12th of 2010, and had not been heard from. And she asked me if I could track him down. And at the time, the only thing that worked were things like Facebook, which I had not been on. And actually, a student of mine put me on Facebook. And she said, this is how you'll be able to connect. And she was right. I connected to colleagues and writers who were friends of mine who worked at the Université de l'État in Haiti. And I gave them the names that I had, the contact names, the student's name. And the reply I got was, your student is alive, but all of your contacts are dead. And I had 5 or 7 contacts. And so then I had the awful position of having to contact my friend and say, you know, the person you're looking for did survive, but all of your contacts for that person are dead. And that was only about 3-4 weeks in after the earthquake. We're still trying to find out if people were alive, you know, or not. And I remember at that moment thinking, this is going to be one of the hardest things I'll ever have to go through, because I realized so many people were counting on me to make connections and find people. And from that point on, that was the case, that often you would find the person you were looking for, but the people you thought would help you find them had passed away. So it's really been, you know, it was an arduous time. And one of the compelling reasons for me to write the novel is that I realized a few years later that even though I was still very much working on issues in Haiti and assisting as much as I could, most people who are not related to Haiti had forgotten what had happened. You know, so when the anniversary would roll around, there were fewer and fewer news reports about it, fewer things going on. And now, you know, there was just another earthquake on August 14th. And one of the things that has come up are how many people who went through 2010 who are newly traumatized by this event. And, you know, everything coming back up, because it is an ongoing kind of healing process. And for me, writing the novel was a healing process. And I think just to complete my thought on this, to go back to my family, a number of members of my family who were older passed away in the last 3 to 5 years, some of whom had been through the earthquake. And one of the things I observed with them is how differently everyone coped with the experience of the earthquake, where I had, you know, some elderly relatives who were right in the epicenter, like we're right in the middle of Port-au-Prince, saw everything, would not talk about the earthquake, their experience of it, but then clearly had a kind of descent after in terms of their coping, their ability to cope. While others, you know, stayed in Haiti, you know, were very implicated, they tended to be younger. And so I think that was one of my motivating factor for having an elderly woman, you know, sort of be the bookends for the novel, you know, the opening and ending piece, Market Woman, because I wanted to give voice to, you know, to an older person who lives through the earthquake and copes as best she can. And in her case is able to cope. But I know from my lived experience, not everybody is able to do that.
Wow. It's amazing how an entire nation sort of gets through something, and the way they do that and the history and what it means to be one person going through something that is such a collective trauma. I mean, it's not unlike 9/11 exactly. Here, except the scale of it is so much bigger there. I mean, it's like, it's hard. Yeah. It's really hard to wrap your mind around that number of losses. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it's hard to process, especially when you feel that you're like in charge to some extent, or that, you know, that must have been such a, I mean, to have to shoulder that is a lot.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. As kids get older, some things about parenting can get easier. I mean, not many, but some. But others don't, like having conversations about money. Point is, kids won't really know how to manage their money unless they're actually in charge of it, and that is where Greenlight can help. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on their kids' spending and saving, while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills. With the Greenlight app, kids can learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely, thanks to games that teach money skills in a fun and accessible way. I got Greenlight debit cards for my kids. The greatest thing, you can actually add their photos that take up half the card. So when I handed the cards to the kids, they were like, this is so exciting. So they look great. Unfortunately, I only put the required 2 cents on at the beginning to make sure they worked. So the kids were like, well, what should I spend my 2 cents on? Anyway, millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. It's the easy, convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and families to navigate life together. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/Zibby. That's greenlight.com/Zibby to try Greenlight for free. Greenlight.com/Zibby.
It's a very complex, and I think what I wanted to try to do in the novel was to give voice to, because one of the things people hear a lot when they hear about Haiti is the word resilience. And I wanted to maybe shift that discourse a little bit more towards persistence, mm-hmm. you know, because I think in the word resilience, you have this idea that a group of people, a culture can take anything on, you know, or, you know, as you were mentioning with 9/11, that New Yorkers can soldier on. And I think that does a disservice to those, you know, individuals who may not have the support systems or the coping skills. And that is as valuable and a story to know about, you know, that these traumas are very complex. And though they're talked about as if groups of people, you know, survive and move on, there's also a kind of way in which not everybody can move on, not everybody should move on. In fact, it should be a kind of integration of what has happened and a kind of honoring of those people that have been lost. You know, I one of the things that has stayed with me is that, you know, I may have known the names of a few people who passed away, but I don't know the name of upwards of 200,000 people. You know, I will never know them, because especially in Haiti, there are not necessarily roles, you know, people are not necessarily registered in terms of birth certificates, death certificates, and so on. And there are whole family groups that disappeared. And so they can't be quantified. We don't know who they are. So in some way, in a very small way, in a humble way, I'd like to say, you know, taking 10 people, 10 stories, and putting a kind of face, even though a fictional face, to them was a way to kind of stand in for all those thousands of people whose stories will never be told. Yeah.
Wow. So this book took you about 7-8 years-ish to write?
Yeah, 5 years for the main writing, and then probably another 3 years of revision as it went through editorial processes.
Oh my goodness. So do you have like parallel projects, or are you going to start another one, or do you work on a lot of things at the same time, or what's your process like?
Yeah, I normally work on two books at the same time, an academic book and a creative book. The parallel book for this one has actually already appeared, most people won't see the parallel. It's an academic book. It got a Guggenheim, which is lovely, but it was about reading the work of people of African descent through their own lenses and how that might create a different discourse for all of us that is not really race-based, but more about culture. And I use a lot of Haitian concepts to do that, like the lacou, the yard, the combit, which is the idea of a collective. But the connection between the two books is actually a film by a Haitian filmmaker, Raoul Peck, who also did a film on the earthquake, on the post-earthquake situation, a documentary, which is called Fatal Assistance. But the film for the academic book was Sometimes in April, which is his film on the genocide in Rwanda. And so I was really, taken by the idea that a Haitian filmmaker chose to make a film about what happened in Rwanda. And I started thinking about what's that conversation like. And I had the chance to speak to him about the fact that there are some parallels with Haitian history in terms of friction between Haitians and Dominicans, because we occupy the same island and a massacre that took place in 1937 under Trujillo. And he said, yeah, I wasn't thinking about that, but that there is a connection there. And so the connection to the novel is that I did spend a little bit of time in Rwanda and visited women's cooperatives there. And it felt a lot like Haiti. And I really could see why he was drawn to that story. And this is why one of the characters, then you'll find her in Rwanda. And I try to make parallels between Haiti and Rwanda in her experience of what people are grieving there at the time that she's there, which is in early 2010.
Wow. And having written a bunch of books, including your award-winning academic work and all the rest, what advice do you have for aspiring authors?
You know, my one big piece of advice, which goes back to when I started publishing in Canada, actually, as a teen, short stories and essays, is to work with editors as much as you can. I was very lucky to have a professor as an undergrad who was also an editor, who really helped me with my writing and just, told me, send the work out, send it out. She taught me how to write a cover letter, and the one big thing she told me is always ask for feedback. She said, you may not get it, but if you have a line in your letter that says feedback is welcome, they will feel compelled to send you something. Mm-hmm. And that's been true 9 out of 10 times, even when the feedback has been a little bit rough, which it can be at the beginning. I've gotten feedback, and I find that editors are the most selfless people in terms of giving you feedback on your work, because they want the work, especially in literary fiction, they want your work, but it's also true on the academic side. They want the work to be the best that it can be. And so I've learned a lot. My editors at HarperCollins Canada and Tin House, Maisie Cochran at Tin House, have been just amazing. And if I didn't listen to them, my work would be the poorer for it.
And what do you like to read? Like, what are some of your favorites, or what are you reading now?
What am I reading now? So I just read After Parties by So, which I thought was a wonderful collection. Let me see. I'm, of course, reading Theory, which is probably not what a lot of people are reading. But I like Hashim Mbembe's work. He has a new book called Out of the Dark, which I would recommend. And of course, I'm reading the new book by Jeffers, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. I just started that.
I love that.
I'm looking forward. I think it might take me a few months to get through it, but it has a great beginning. So I'm looking forward to it being a nice winter read.
Excellent. Amazing. And just last question on Haiti, like what can people do now? Like what for the someone who cares and wants to help and, what can people do?
Yeah, thank you for asking, because I know there's been a bit of controversy around this since the last earthquake and the month before the Haitian president was assassinated. So I know Haiti has been in the news, but just after the last earthquake, there was a lot going on around, should people give to Haiti because of mismanagement of funds after the 2010 earthquake? So just a couple of quick things to say about that is that less than 1% of funds went to the Haitian government. So the mismanagement wasn't, it wasn't Haitians who mismanaged those funds. I always say try to give to grassroots organizations that have a longstanding record in Haiti of doing work, of having low overhead, and really working with the people, you know, and working with in the sense of finding out what people need on the ground. Haitian-led organizations tend to do a better job because they know what's happening in country. I would say, you know, try to find out. Sometimes, you know, you can find out through groups that you're already connected to. They might be church groups. They might be community organizations where you live, especially in New York, especially in Miami, Boston, where there are large Haitian communities. I've been in touch with a number of groups that I was in touch with because of 2010 and before, and ask for lists. So one of the key things this time around is that help is really needed in the Southern Peninsula, less so in Port-au-Prince. But there are some organizations in Port-au-Prince, like Focal, that have units in the Southern Peninsula and are redistributing funds there. I did also collect from those groups lists of groups that they recommend. And I have a list on my website of Haiti Relief Fund, so people can also go there. And I always say to people, when you find a group that is something that you're interested in, you know, do the research, find out if they have a transparent plan, find out what their reports are, you know, from past giving and what they've done. Do they have images, you know, reporting back? And what have they accomplished? And can you have confidence in them? And if you do, then please, 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 if whatever you can, give, because a little bit in a place like Haiti goes really far. So if, you know, somebody only has $10 to give, that's amazing. It will do a lot, you know.
Good to know. Amazing. Well, Miriam, it was lovely to meet you. My second Haitian Miriam in my life now.
That's so great. Yeah. There's so few of us, actually.
Yeah. She's
it's not a common name.
She's from Holland originally, but her family spent, and in fact, they still live there. But anyway, so I hear, as I've told you, Haiti is often discussed in our home, and, you know, she's there a lot. That's and great. All the rest. So anyway, thank you so much for your time. Good luck with the
book. Thank you, Zibi.
And thanks for letting me snag your first spot.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I really appreciate it. And I'll keep listening to the podcast too.
Thank you. Please
take care.
So nice. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibi Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibiOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.